and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This episode, we're featuring an expert on German, European, and transatlantic foreign and security policy. Today's presenter is Constance Stelzenmüller. Her talk is titled, Europe, America's Partner, America's Problem. This event took place on May 5th at 49th State Brewing Company and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Dale Cope, a board member for the Alaska World Affairs Council, provides the introduction.
Good afternoon. I'm Dale Cope, a member of the board of the World Affairs Council, working to bring the world to Alaska. I'm delighted to introduce our speaker today, Constance Stelzenmüller. Okay, good. Dr. Stelzenmüller is the inaugural Robert Bosch Senior Fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institute. Prior to working at Brookings Institute, she was a Senior Transatlantic Fellow with the German Marshall Fund of the United States, where she directed the influential Transatlantic Trends Survey Program. And you can see the results of that survey online. I looked. Stelzenmüller is the former director of the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office. From 1994 to 2005, she was an editor for the political section of the German weekly Die Zeit. Okay. Where she also served as defense and international security editor and covered human rights issues and humanitarian crises. Stelzenmüller's essays and articles in both German and English have appeared in a wide range of publications, and she is also a frequent commentator on American and European radio and television, including Press Club, National Public Radio, and the BBC. I was able to read a number of her recent articles on the Brookings Institute website. So. Stelzenmüller holds a doctorate in law from the University of Bonn, a master's degree in public administration from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and a law degree from the University of Bonn. Dr. Stelzenmüller is an expert on German, European, and transatlantic foreign and security policy and strategy. She is here today to speak to us, Europe, America's partner, America's problem. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Stelzenmüller to the podium.
Thank you so much for that kind welcome. I maybe should have suggested just changing it to Constance. My last name is a mouthful for anybody, including in Germany, and I have to say one of my biggest challenges in radio interviews, particularly if they're not German, is not giggling when the moderator makes a flying jump for my last name. But you did it extremely well. Thank you so much. And I want to say thank you for the delightful hospitality I've been receiving so far, including the moose. I appreciate you going to all that trouble. That was an impressive moose, and I also think these chandeliers, I have to say, are mesmerizing. So I won't be able to fit that in carry-on, I fear, but it's tempting. So I also want to say a word of thank you to the World Affairs Council. I believe the way this invitation came about was that somebody heard me on NPR, who's on the board, and I think then wrote to me and said, would you be willing to come to Alaska and speak someday on the issues you were talking about on NPR just now? And I wrote back immediately and said, yes, when? And for a variety of reasons, private and professional, I couldn't quite make it then, but I said at the time, look, let's just, you know, keep trying this and hope it works out, and now it has. I'm really thrilled to be here because this is my very first trip to Alaska, and what a beautiful state it is. So thank you. I spent yesterday in Juneau, a very enthusiastic host there, and Carl Brodesen, who showed me the glacier, the State Museum, which is awesome. And I spoke to a very enthusiastic crowd there, and I was really touched by the welcome the warmth and the interest in transatlantic and European issues that I got here. And I'm deducing from the size of this crowd that it's not just the prospect of a nice meal that's drawn you here, but that you feel a sense of community with each other and with the issues discussed here at these World Affairs Councils. And I think that's lovely. As a European who has spent a lot of time, as you said, living in America, I thank you for that and that sense of community, and may it long endure. So I've come here to talk to you today about, and you'll have to tell me if I am moving, and you know what, I'm going to sit, or rather put myself here so I won't move in front of the microphone all the time. And you tell me if this works out or if I move too far away from it. I'm good? All right, great. So I was asked to talk about Europe, and the title I chose was Europe, America's Partner, America's Problem, because this is currently, as we all know, sort of a double-edged issue. There are a lot of things to be concerned about, and other things, and in fact, concerned about both in America and in Europe. And I will talk about a little of, about both of those issues now, and then I think you said I should talk for about 25 minutes, yep. And then I will shut up, or try to, and then I will welcome your questions and comments. And I do mean that because one of the reasons I enjoy giving these talks across America is that for people like me who are essentially policy wonks, it's very easy to get caught up in our own little bubble, even if we don't think we are. And of course, Washington is another bubble. Mm-hmm. And so I've been trying to make a point of getting out of that and engaging with people who, you know, aren't part of that. And I'm always hoping to learn from your questions and your comments. So I mean that very seriously. So let me start out with a little overview of the challenges that I think we're currently facing. And if some of those sound sort of familiar to you from your own political space here in America, maybe that's no coincidence and something that we could talk about. It's certainly something that we were talking about at a little breakfast meeting this morning at this great coffee shop that Alyssa Bish took me to. The first challenge, of course, the thing that's on all of our minds and that many Europeans, I think, accurately think of as a make or break moment for Europe is the French elections. The second round tomorrow, the day after tomorrow on Sunday, where a young and relatively inexperienced Democrat, passionately pro-European, passionately pro-internationalist, but relatively new young politician called Philippe Macron is pitched against the daughter of a gentleman who has been a fixture of the French far right for decades. Somebody who I think is her father can quite properly be called an anti-Semite and a racist, and somebody who has views that you can't call democratic. She has tried to distance herself from that, but I think most observers think that that's basically just window dressing. And that she has made clear over time that she shares many of those views. And certainly in the last presidential debate 2 nights ago, which took 3 hours and pitched the two remaining challengers from the first round 2 weeks ago against each other, she dropped all pretense of moderation, all pretense of trying to attract more moderate sectors of the electorate, was apparently really aggressive in attacking him, suggesting, you know, that he might have, I don't know, bank accounts somewhere on some island squirreled away without, you know, a shred of evidence, and hinting otherwise that he was untrustworthy, while at the same time, when asked about answers for policy problems, not providing any of those. So for us Europeans, and I think for many people in France, this really is going to be a bellwether, not just for France, but for Europe. Because France, together with Germany, after Brexit, which I'll talk about in a second, are the two remaining big engines of Europe in one way or another. And for France to be even standing in front of such a decision is, to many Europeans, and certainly many Germans, my own country, a truly terrifying proposition. And while we're keeping our fingers crossed for Sunday, I think it is by no means excluded that Marine Le Pen, the challenger, the right-wing challenger, could win, and then all bets are off for the future of Europe. So that's the French election. I have a couple more on my list. Then there's Brexit. Brexit, you will all have heard about. The Brits, the Great Britain is now the first country to seek exit from the European Union. It held a referendum last summer in June on the question, which the people proposing exit narrowly won. And ever since then, the government in London, the government of Theresa May, and the European Union and its member states have been attempting to negotiate the terms of that exit. And again, because there is a treaty provision for this, but there is no experience, and in fact, there are no real hard and fast rules of how to do this in praxis. And in practice, this has, in particularly in recent weeks and days, become a really, really nasty fight. And I will say nasty on both sides. I mean, nobody is really attempting to maintain the moral high ground here, although I will say that I think my own country's Chancellor Angela Merkel is at least trying. But a lot of people otherwise engaged in these negotiations are not covering themselves in glory. Now, Brexit, and I will admit here, I'll be very frank, Brexit, like the French elections, is an issue on which I cannot be neutral. I don't think there is a sort of middle ground on this one, although it's a little clearer in France where you have an anti-democratic candidate pitched against a democratic candidate. But I personally believe, based on what I've seen, based on conversations with British friends, based on what I've heard from British and European politicians, that Brexit will not fulfill the expectations of those who are hoping for Britain's exit from the EU, and I think it will be damaging for Great Britain and it will be damaging for Europe. Why do I say that? Why is it damaging for Europe? Very simply because Great Britain was a really important member state in Europe when it came to security, foreign policy, and trade. They had a very forward-leaning, very engaged, highly professional diplomacy and security policy. If you needed military support for a European mission, it was always good to have the Brits at your side. They are committed members of NATO, and of course they have the special relationship with America. All of that made them precious in foreign and security policy. And from a German point of view, because we tend to be more of sort of a free market thinking and on trade, it was also really important to have the Brits in the game on issues that were related to trade or financial services. That's one point where Berlin tended to disagree with Paris. The French are a lot more protectionist and statist on many of these issues. So this is going to be bad for the EU, no question. Why do I think it's also going to be bad for the Brits? Because I think that the idea that the Leavers campaigned on, which is that Britain would regain sovereignty and would regain control, is fundamentally an illusion. I think that sovereignty in an age of globalization and interconnectedness through technology, through trade, through economic and societal bonds, is something that has become notional and has, I think, limited the powers of state governments everywhere to impose policies and to impose outcomes or to even control them. And modern politics is trying to live with that, trying to adapt to a situation where the nation state can no longer control territory, people, and outcomes, but rather has to mitigate, to manage risks, but can never completely exclude them. That I think is the situation in which we all find ourselves in, and I think that's true even for America to some degree. And so I think that the Brits will find themselves in a rather difficult situation. There's another element here that I think much of the criticism leveled in England against Brussels and supposedly Brussels bureaucracy and centralization could equally well, or with more legitimacy, have been leveled against London. The United Kingdom is like France, or is together with France, one of the most centralized countries in Europe. You have an incredibly strong and powerful and wealthy metropolis in London and Paris, and you have very little devolution of powers to the regions, particularly to the periphery of these countries. So you have enormous metropolitan urban divides against the rural or post-industrial or industrial zones of Greater Britain and Greater France. And that is where a lot of the unhappiness that people are expressing comes from. And finally, one point that I think the Brexiteers will also regret and are already regretting is, and it's something that people aren't really aware of, the EU gives a lot of money to member states for infrastructure and development, particularly for underdeveloped regions. If any of you have been to Europe, you'll often find in poorer regions big signs on the roads, on very good roads, with the EU's flag, a dark blue ground and the golden circle of stars, saying this road was built with funding from the European Union. You can find those everywhere. I've traveled as a reporter across Europe. And they have played a huge role because they've enabled people and goods to move, because they've brought prosperity to regions that were otherwise disadvantaged. And I think that a lot of the poorer regions of Britain will find that losing these funds makes a huge difference to their prosperity, and I frankly worry about that because that's not going to be good for the politics either. A lot of the people who voted for Brexit in those regions will be horribly disappointed. So my next challenge is refugees. It will not have escaped you that there was a big refugee crisis in Europe in 2015, and that nearly a million Syrians, followed then by a lot of other migrants who came for more economic reasons because of the abject poverty of their own regions in Northern Africa or the Middle East or Sub-Saharan Africa, made their way under the most horrific conditions across Africa, across the Middle East, and then either took smuggler boats across the Mediterranean, more often than not capsizing and sometimes perishing in the attempt under horrific circumstances, or trying the land routes through Turkey and the Balkans up into Central Europe and including to my own country, Germany. And for a while in 2015, it seemed as though Europe and its member states and Turkey itself would be completely overwhelmed by this sudden surge in this outflow of refugees. And there were a lot of stories at the time that Europe was going to explode or implode, and this would be a humanitarian disaster of the worst kind because it would never be possible to stop this or to manage it in the places where the refugees arrived, and that Europeans would basically be riven by acrimony and horrible disagreements for the foreseeable future. Oddly, it hasn't quite happened that way, and the two main reasons are that Germany and Sweden took in most of the refugees when other countries refused, and then we had a deal with Turkey to control the further outflows. And oddly, if you'd asked me in 2015, I had already moved to Washington, I moved there in the fall of 2014, how this would go in Germany, I would have said, oh, you know, the German state and its authorities will manage this problem, absolutely no question, and civil society will be very upset. And bizarrely, I was proven completely wrong. It was the other way around. You saw municipal and regional and state authorities floundering and the federal government going like this. And meanwhile, civil society calmly rolled up its sleeves and said, all right, let's deal with this sucker. And it was amazing. I mean, some of my closest friends, and I could see this from their Facebook feeds, who have 24/7 jobs in government or in hospitals or whatnot, started volunteering in refugee camps, started giving German language training, started helping people find housing, took on guardianships for unaccompanied minors. The 82-year-old mother of a friend of mine in Eastern Germany, a retired gynecologist doctor, said, well, clearly some of these ladies are going to need a gynecologist, and reinserted herself into the workforce, you know, and started providing medical services to these ladies, who I'm sure were grateful. So oddly, you know, that one turned my German prejudices on its head. And at this point, it seems to me that we've got the situation pretty much under control. People have been distributed, have found housing, are learning German, and yes, there are some who, for one reason or another, won't get asylum in Germany because they've come for other reasons and will be sent back. Are there people who are, have we seen an uptick in aggression against refugees? Yes. Have we seen hate crimes? Yes. Have we seen crime by refugees? Yes, we have seen that too. Is there a terrorist risk of infiltration? Yes, of course. But so far, the net judgment of the current situation is that this has worked reasonably well. And that for given the you know, the size of this crowd that came to Germany and asked for asylum, given that we were completely unprepared for this and the Swedes were completely unprepared for this, it's actually gone amazingly well. But of course, a renewal of strife and conflict in the Middle East, a breakdown of the EU-Turkey deal, all of this could lead to a further worsening of the situation, and that, I think, is something that we all have to contemplate and plan against. Let me talk about my next set of challenges, and I've basically already mentioned conflict and failure of the failing regional order and failing states in Northern Africa and the Middle East. That's a list so long that I can't possibly go into detail, but Libya, post the Western intervention, which I thought was necessary, it was necessary to depose Muammar al-Gaddafi. He was threatening to kill his own population. But since then, Libya has been descending into sectarian and tribal strife in the most awful way, and we haven't been able to find a grip on that. I think Egypt, with its very tenuous economy, run mostly by the military, is a potential time bomb. Syria, of course, is one of the most horrific civil wars and humanitarian disasters we've seen in a century. I think it's a blot on the honor of mankind. And nobody really seems to have an answer. I mean, I was actually quite for bombing their airstrip, but I'm not sure that that's changed anything. Then there's Russia. It will also not have escaped you that we've been having a little bit of a problem with Russia recently. Russia has first goaded Georgia into a week-long war in 2008. That one we thought was worrying. We didn't take it particularly seriously, also because Georgia's then leader, Mikhail Saakashvili, really was an easy person to goad, it has to be said. But the Russians chopped off bits of Georgia's territory, and that was noted and did not go down well. But things really went downhill when the Russians annexed Crimea in the spring of 2014, when the Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine shot down by mistake, presumably, a Malaysian airplane carrying a lot of Dutch people, and then this was flight MH17, then treated the authorities of the Netherlands and the relatives of the people who had died in this horrific accident with the utmost disrespect. Finally, the fact that Russia is still stoking violence and strife in eastern Ukraine and continues to lie about it. And not least, the fact that Russia is interfering all across the European space proper, the space of the EU and NATO, by meddling in elections, by meddling in social media, by funding parties and extremists, populists, from the Balkans, really, to indeed to Germany and France. That is something that has really raised a huge amount of concern. It's being addressed within NATO, it's being addressed within the EU, and by our own domestic intelligence services. But the publics are really upset about that, and it has really changed completely the relationship with Russia. And so for the foreseeable future, that may be the single biggest state-shaped challenge that we have on our borders. And finally, of course, we have the challenge that you also have heard about of rising populism, authoritarianism, illiberalism, particularly in Hungary, where Viktor Orban, the head of the leader of Hungary, has been essentially, like Erdogan in Turkey, another challenge, has been reshaping the country's constitution to cement his own rule, to get rid of political pluralism, and to shape and basically to keep his party in power for the foreseeable future. Growth has been, and our economic health has been less of an issue than it's been at least during the financial crisis. We had a horrific financial crisis, as did you, but we, like America, are now seeing quite robust growth again. That's not to say that some of the economic fundamentals aren't worrying, I think we would be foolish to exclude a potential return of the financial crisis because some of our fundamentals really are weak. Italian banks, for example, Greek institutions, and so on. I could go on at length about that. But I think I want to raise one more challenge, which I think is actually the one that underlies all of the ones that I've named and the responses to them, and is one that I think is also familiar to you, at least based on my conversations at breakfast this morning and in Juneau yesterday. It really strikes a chord with many Americans, and that is The fundamental question that I think we have to look at and that we have to decide as societies and polities is the attitude that we have to our connectedness with the world. The catchword for that is globalization. It sounds a little wonky. What it really means is open borders, trade, and the democratization, if you will, of mobility and communication through technical and innovation, which has brought us enormous advances in prosperity and in peace and in connectedness, but also has brought enormous vulnerabilities and risk. And the thing that we've had to learn in recent years is that it has made some people more prosperous than others, or a lot more prosperous, and that it has made some people much more vulnerable than others, and you could also say a lot more vulnerable. And that has generated fears and angers about control and about state power and sovereignty, which are easily exploitable by populists and authoritarians. And that, I think, is something that Americans and Europeans truly share. And what's so scary about that is that it seems to have changed the way people think about their democracies. It seems to have changed the way people think about political institutions and about what is called liberal democracy. And by liberal democracy, I don't mean liberal as opposed to conservative, or liberal in the sense of, libertarian. But I mean liberal in the sense of a belief in the necessity of limited government, which is, after all, one of the principles that the framers of the American Constitution in the 18th century enshrined in your Constitution, long may it last, and made it into a model for the rest of the Western world. And that's the limited government meaning that no branch of government, whether the legislative, the executive, or the courts, should be all powerful, but need to be balanced out and separated from the others, so that they no one branch of government can become authoritarian or dictatorial. And because people are afraid of loss of control, you suddenly find them engaging in public debate about whether this is a good thing, and whether you don't need strong men, or whether we don't need authoritarian leaders to help us achieve growth, bring jobs back, rid us of dangerous enemies, or maybe even of tedious allies. And that, I think, is a really big concern. Have to say, as a European, and as you said, I wrote my German doctoral thesis on American constitutional law. I have something close to reverence for American constitutional law and your constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And I didn't think that it was possible to have that kind of debate here. Nor did I think with our German experience, that it was possible to have the debate in my country. So let me move to my second set of remarks, which is, what answers are there? Now, I am not going to give you answers to all the list of challenges that I've listed, because then we'd be here until the evening, and I don't think you have time for that. But I will say one thing, which is that there is no one-size-fits-all answer for these problems. But I think there is a commonality. I think there really is. I think the one thing that we have found is that our ability to engage with each other as nations, both within Europe and in the transatlantic space between Europe and America, hinges intimately on how we are constituted at home. I think it's obvious that we're not going to be legitimate foreign policy actors if we are not democracies at home, because people who engage with us abroad will say, but you know, if you're not a democracy, why would we trust you? Why would we think that you have better intentions? Why would we think that you can do things better than, you know, Kim Jong-un or Vladimir Putin? That's one part of that. I would also say that democracies tend to run better. They're better at guaranteeing liberties. They're better at guaranteeing prosperity in the long run, certainly. And so it is representative limited democracy that provides for our ability to have power, that provide for our ability to engage in trade with other nations, and to have strong and trust-based international relations. And so a lot of what we now need to look at, I think, is not so much foreign policy vis-a-vis Russia, Iran, or China, although we have to do that too, but I think we have to look to our own weaknesses.
the weaknesses of our institutions, of our democratic processes, of our markets, and our social contracts. And these are problems that we know we have in Europe and that we need to look to and we need to fix. And I suspect, at least from my conversations with American friends in Washington, but also across the country in recent months, that you are having conversations about what might need to be fixed in America as well.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from transatlantic foreign and security policy expert Constance Stelzenmuller and her talk, Europe, America's Partner, America's Problem. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at 49th State Brewing Company on May 5th. We return now to the program.
One problem that Europe has, of course, is how much Europe, in other words, how much European federalism do we need? How much European Union do we need to solve the problems that we have? And like you, like this nation, has had a permanent back and forth since 1789 about the ideal and desirable relationship between the states and the federal government back in Washington, which here is on the other side of the continent. It took me, I think, 14 hours doorstep to doorstep to get here 2 days ago, which was amazing. And it would have been 8 more hours if I'd started in Europe. I can see that that seems very far away. But I think you also know that Alaska or Anchorage have problems that can't just be solved in Anchorage or in Alaska. Yeah? These are things that you need to talk to Seattle about, or Canada, or indeed Washington. And that's our problem with the European Union is of a similar nature. Yeah? This isn't some sort of super federalist project. It's not an ideology. It's about when is it useful to push up a problem to the level where we all try and resolve it together, because it affects us all in similar ways, and when it is useful to leave it to the nation state. It's really no different from what you've been debating as a nation for 200 years. And we're again in one of those situations where we're saying, well, at 28, you know, shouldn't we really be having a sort of more common defense? Should we not be having a common refugee policy? And if we have another financial crisis, shouldn't we be having a more common financial policy, particularly since 17 of us already have a common currency in the euro? So that's where we are. Let me also say, because the news or the reporting about Europe here in the American media has been uniformly sort of disaster area reporting, let me also say a couple things that weirdly have worked. The Greeks, you know, everybody thought Greek would leave the European Union because of their financial crisis, or that they would buckle under the austerity conditions imposed, among others, by Germany. I actually think you can criticize with some justice. But actually, the Greeks are still with the program. The Greeks have not left the EU, and I don't think they're going to. I think they're using this as an opportunity to reform themselves and blame somebody else for it. Belgium. Everybody thought after these horrific Belgian terrorist attacks that Belgium was going to implode and become a disaster area and a breeding ground for Muslim terrorists. Hasn't happened. Does Belgium have a couple governance problems? Sure it does. But it's still there. You'd be surprised how vibrant a place Belgium is if you've ever been. Brexit. Everybody thought that Brexit would be the beginning of the end of the unraveling of Europe. I can't tell you how many conservative think tank papers in Washington I've read that have said this. It's not happening. If anything, there is a Brexit effect to the contrary, where people are hewing to the mean, and our polls are saying, no, 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 we want to stay in Europe. We think this is a good thing. And in France, everybody thought Marine Le Pen, the anti-democratic challenger, could win the first round, and that would be it. She hasn't. And right now, the polls are saying Macron, the Democrat, is getting about 68%, and she might get, 60, and she might get 40, or he might get 62, 38. It's possible that those polls could be wrong, but they've actually been much more accurate than the ones in this election, for reasons that aren't entirely clear to me. So it's more likely, and I'm sorry, and that's not a criticism of yours. I used to run a poll, as you said, and their polls are really tricky to do, and in times when people no longer have landlines, it's actually very hard to make them representative. But I think that France actually might get a chance to clean itself up. And Germany has not imploded, as everybody predicted it would in 2015, under 800,000 refugees. And one of the more touching things to me, and this is also something I see on my Facebook feed every day, is that on Sundays, for the last couple months or so, some of my friends and many thousands of other people have taken to going to demonstrate, and this is really rare in Europe, for something rather than against something. People have been demonstrating on big public squares in Europe for Europe and for European unity. You know, waving European flags, giving impromptu speeches about how important Europe is to them, you know, taking their family and grandparents and children's buggies and whatnot. I find that very touching. And that's a new thing. There appears to be a sense of, you know, we need to fight for this. We thought we were entitled to it, we thought we could take it for granted, and now we need to actually preserve this and make sure that it survives. And that I think also tells you something. Are there remaining risks? Of course there are. Could there be large-scale terrorist attacks? Yes. Could the Russians persist on this course of fragility and aggression? Absolutely. I don't expect an attack against the Baltics, but I do expect them to continue meddling in a very nefarious and hostile way with the European project, and that's concern enough for me, frankly. Could there be new refugee inflows, for example, if the relationship between Europe and Turkey worsens, or if Erdogan completely derails? Yes, of course. Could the financial crisis return? Absolutely. Could there be a military conflict in East Asia? Yes, you're currently talking about that with North Korea, and that would have a massive impact on us because of the tremendous amount of trade that Europe, and indeed my own country, Germany, has with China, Japan, and South Korea. That would have a massive knock-on effect because of the economic integration that we have. So this would, although we aren't militarily present in the Pacific, it would have a huge impact. In fact, I think that that would be enough to set off another global financial crisis, if you ask me. Now, arguably, Russia's aggression has really cemented us together in Europe in ways that we couldn't have imagined previously. I remember when I arrived here in 2014, people kept saying to me, whether in the State Department or in the Pentagon or in think tank debates, you realize that your anti-Russian sanctions, your sanctions against Russia will never hold up because you're too disunited. Well, guess what? They're still there because we're really pissed off. And so they've been holding, thank you very much, for 3 years. Are they at risk? Yes. Do individual European nations who want to do trade with Russia, do they want to get rid of the sanctions? Yes. But you know, right now, there is a tremendous sense of unity around this, and that has really helped. So arguably, a new crisis, a sort of these challenges becoming reality and turning into a disaster could arguably bring us closer together, but they could also really have a fragmenting effect. They could really damage the European project. And the bigger reason why I say all this, there is one really huge reason that I haven't mentioned yet, and that is the United States of America. The reason why all of what I've just described is reason why what Washington now says or does, or does not do or does not say, can have a huge impact on what happens to us. There are so many ways in which your friendship, or the opposite of that, could have a massive impact on our ability to deal with our own challenges ourselves. I mean, I don't think we would actually need American massive help except in the case of outright war, which I don't think is likely at all. I think it could be helpful if there were a medium-sized military crisis to have American contributions, but I do think that we're gearing up to at least try and be able to do that ourselves. But because so much of the challenges that we're facing aren't really warlike, aren't really military in nature, they're political, they're diplomatic, they're trade-based, our diplomatic and economic relationship with America has really taken center stage. And I will also say to you, and I watch this space very closely, that this administration is the first one since 1945 to fundamentally question its commitment to Europe, its commitment to NATO, and its commitment to the European Union. Not just that, I watch this maybe more closely than you do, but there has been some amazingly hostile language out of this administration towards Europe, particularly towards the EU, and particularly towards Germany, which has been depicted by some of the members of this administration as somehow the puppet master of a nefarious European Union that is out to basically screw the Americans out of a fair deal. Forgive me for putting it this way. But it's pretty close to what people actually say. And that's sort of a new quality to the language out of Washington, and it's really concerning. Our answer as European, and my answer as a European, as a German, would be some of that criticism is absolutely valid, and I've tried to say in my initial remarks why it is. Of course we need to get our act together. Of course we need to fix things. We need to do more on defense. We need to increase our defense budgets, or we're already doing that because of Russia. And we need to correct trade imbalances, sure. But the sort of the really radical version of this anti-EU, anti-Germany criticism coming out of parts of Washington, I think is just completely, it doesn't match the reality that I know. And so it's really hard to engage with because underlying it is a really quite radical anti-globalization narrative. In fact, they call it globalism as though it were some kind of an ideology that you could check out of.
Yeah.
And I can see why people would be worried about globalization. As I've been trying to say, some people here really have suffered. Some people do live in the dark side of globalization, whether it's in West Virginia or in the old steel mill areas of the Midwest, Ohio, Pennsylvania. I get that. And opiate addiction among the people who have been out of work for a long time, I get that too. Those are real problems and they are real grievances, and I think they need to be addressed. But I think and I also actually get why America could conceivably think that it would be the only country on earth that gets to check out of globalization. Because you have a huge territorial space, you have enormous internal markets, you have all the strategic resources you need, including now oil. And you have natural boundaries in the form of two oceans and a friendly nation, Canada. Well, friendly maybe not on every issue. I know that there is issues with the Arctic policy. But, and Mexico, which is maybe a little more complicated. But you could conceivably get away with this, although I do think that checking out of international trade and diplomacy would make America's life much less rich and much less prosperous, if you ask me. And certainly you'd be cutting yourself off from an awful lot of, social connections that you have with the rest of the world, including with us in Europe. But in Europe, that simply isn't possible. If you try to visualize a map of Europe, it has all these little sort of frilly borders. Those are indefensible. We can't just build walls around Europe. It's impossible to stop people from coming in. And frankly, we would be cutting ourselves off from our lifeblood. We live from trade and mobility. We live from engagement with the world. It's what makes us richer in ideas, in people, and in goods. And so for us, globalization isn't an ism. It's something that we will have to learn to manage, and we will certainly have to manage the impact of the more damaging aspects, but it's not something that we can just check out of. So let me get to my last remarks, and then I'm already in overtime. We are aware, and people like me who are watching this sort of space and what the administration is saying very closely, we know that a lot of the administration's attention has been devoted to domestic matters like healthcare and other things. We also have seen that there have been reversals, right? The president himself has reversed himself on his attitudes to EU and NATO and even to my own Chancellor Merkel. But the problem with that is that, it's not embedded into anything larger. There is no visible sort of attempt at formulating policy towards Europe and towards NATO and individual European countries. We still don't have an ambassador. There are no American ambassadors yet for many European countries or for Brussels. There are no people in the senior positions in the State Department and in the Defense Department that would be in charge of managing this relationship and that would be writing policy. And the president himself has said in interviews that, we don't think those positions are necessary. Secretary of State Tillerson has said something similar. So in the absence of people who would be executing policy and writing policy, the words or the tweets of individuals carry that much more weight. And as words can move markets. They can also move political markets. They're going to be priced in. And the less policy there is, the less people there are that we know, the more important these words are going to be. And so I think that whatever happens in this space, whether it's just words or it's turned into policy, and whether this hostility that we're hearing turns into actions, it could have a massive impact on Europe. I think in the worst case, it really could mean the tipping point, the thing that moves the needle between European cohesion and a disintegration, a demise of the European Union or of NATO. And I think it would also have a massive effect on US interests, because to the people who think that globalization is an ism, I would say American companies have huge interests in Europe. In Germany alone, there are 700,000 US jobs. Yeah. Our EU-US trade is $699 billion per year, or was in 2016. You have bases in Europe. And we, by the way, pay the cost for the 40% of the cost of those bases. Those bases make it a lot easier for American troops to get to the Middle East or to Northern Africa when they want to. And we, with our diplomacy, our specialized military capabilities, our trade, and our economic and social relations, are the backstop for many of your political strategies with regard not just to Europe, but to, again, Northern Africa, the Middle East, and Russia. We are your partners in this. And not least, we add oomph to American power because we share the same values as you do. So we add legitimacy, and we add legitimacy in numbers, and we add legitimacy because we believe in the same values. And I think to lose all that would be a really high price for the United States that I don't think I can see you really wanting to pay. And I think it'd be very sad if that happened. So where do I think this leaves us? We have to fix our own problems. Absolutely, I mean, and we don't, you know, that we have to do this on our own and on our own, you know, on our own gas. Fix our shortcomings, our vulnerabilities, our failings, both at the EU level and at the national level. We have to remedy trade imbalances. We have to invest more in defense. We have to get all this right. And we have to make a better argument for why all of this is good for the United States. I get that too. But the point that I want to leave you with is that, and I think it may have become clear, but I do want to make it crystal clear, is that Europe and the European Union for us Europeans is not something, you know, we may moan about Brussels like Americans moan about Washington. But the reality is that for the European Progress Project is for us something that's not so dissimilar from the American utopia, the American dream. We, all of us, have memories, either personal or handed on, of war in Europe and austerity and poverty. We know, and I know because I was a reporter, what it is like to not have food, to not have safety, and to have bullets zipping over your head. Our parents lived through this. My dad was an American POW at 16 because he'd been drafted into the Wehrmacht in 1944, despite his mother's best efforts. And he was lucky enough to become an American POW and loved America ever since. Americans sent him to translator school. He worked for the High Commission in Frankfurt and so on. Made a big impact on his life. He also became a set translator on the set of I Was a Male War Bride, the Howard Hawks movie, that was filmed in Northern Hesse, where my mother's from. So if you ever see that, think of it. You have Cary Grant and Anne Sheridan in front of the camera, and Howard Hawks and my dad behind it. So for us, Europe is, yes, it's about peace, it's all about prosperity, and it's about the huge democratic transformation that took place in Eastern Europe when all the nations of Eastern Europe joined the EU after the fall of the wall and the democratic revolutions in those countries. All of that is miracle enough. It's certainly a miracle for me, who I was 27 when the wall came down, and I had never thought that this was going to be possible. It changed my life. My expectations, and it was a joyful moment, and that joyful moment really hasn't ended. So I want you to know that Europe for us is not just a matter of trade, of laws, of rationality, it's also a matter of the heart. It's a utopia that we cling to because it is a utopia that in many ways has become reality, and that we will work and fight to preserve against its adversaries. But we would really like to have America as a friend in this endeavor. And I'll stop here and take your questions. And I realize that was a lot longer than 25 minutes. I'm sorry, I get carried away.
There we go, there we go. So our microphone is not wireless, so if you wouldn't mind coming up to the microphone, we have time for about two questions, and two or three, depending on how quick they are.
Come on. Yes.
And if you could just speak into the microphone for our radio listeners.
Thank you very much for an excellent presentation that was extremely helpful to all of us.
My pleasure.
To understand the world. It was great. I was in Germany in September of 2015 and saw a number of the community responses as people came pouring into the Munich train station, and was impressed by what I saw, the generosity of spirit in terms of the German people offering up food and flowers and toys and all kinds of things. And of course, back home, there was this dialogue about building walls. So I asked some of the German leaders that I had the opportunity to meet with, university business, et cetera, was that just about the human spirit, or was there an economic reason as well? And what I was told, and I'd love to have your comments, that it was also an economic advantage to Germany to have people come with skills, talents, and a commitment to make a new home. I'm curious how that has worked out. Have the immigrants been integrated in a way that has actually helped the German economy and perhaps other economies of Europe as well, which is quite, again, contrary to the way people in the United States think of immigrants, more as a drain as opposed to a net benefit. So how has that turned out?
Okay, thank you. Why don't I take the two or three questions together and try to answer them together, and should we go on to you?
Answer the first question, please.
Okay, all right, fine. Look, I think the simplest answer is we don't quite know yet. It's a little too, after 3 years, we don't quite know. Because the German language isn't that easy. And for grown-up people who have spoken Arabic in all their lives and maybe and have had a Syrian education, even if they're academics, and who maybe speak English or French, that's quite a hurdle. Yeah? So the language and educational training part of this is not as a non-negligible, non-trivial challenge. But apparently, a lot of these people, you know, very often refugees who muster the courage to make it that far, tend to be people who are super resourceful and super motivated. And a lot of these people have been apparently working incredibly hard, and there have been all these stories about kids who arrived without a word of German and who are now, you know, honor students in the universities and law school and stuff like that. I find that amazing. Yeah. But it really, it's, you know, the other thing is that entry-level, educational entry-level barriers for, say, jobs in manufacturing or industry, they're also non-trivial because we have this very demanding vocational training. Yeah. That's, and again, which requires computing abilities, language abilities, and so on. So I think some of that is quite arduous for the refugees and frustrating, but enormous amounts of effort have been going into that, and I think we can make this work. And because you asked about economic benefits, yes, look at German demographics. German demographics, and I like to say that German men just don't try hard enough, but the demographics are what they are. No, the reality is that we've made it really hard for women to work and have children, and that's only slowly changing. That's the real problem. The French make it much easier, which is why in France you see larger families and women working. But the reality is our demographics are such that migration for us is actually kind of a political imperative. So we need to figure out how to make it work. That said, you know, 800,000 arriving at the same time over one summer is not quite everybody's idea of just, you know, of a good starting position. But we have a big incentive to make this work, as do the refugees. So I think that's a pretty good basis for going forward.
So thank you once again for a wonderful talk. You a couple of elections that you didn't mention, a near term and a longer term. Britain will have a parliamentary election quite soon, which may or may not be a second Brexit referendum.
Yep.
But Germany itself will also be facing an election. I'd like to get your thoughts on both of those.
Sure, absolutely. So, yes, Theresa May has, I think, somewhat injudiciously suggested that other Europeans, the Germans and the EU Commission, are trying to interfere in the British elections. And predictably, the Russian embassy in London, which is a prolific tweeter, has been making snarky remarks about this. As in, thank God, you know, for once we're not being blamed. I mean, really, you know, this is getting childish. I do think that people in Britain are having buyer's remorse on some level, and we will see how that goes in the first week of June when the British have their election. Well, I wouldn't dare to predict at this point. The German elections, interestingly, we had been really worried, and by the way, in conjunction with the refugee crisis, about rising poll level and indeed state election numbers for the AfD, our own homegrown right-wing party, the Alternative for Germany, which is becoming more and more right-wing. It started out as an anti-Euro party, and it's been moving really far right, and is becoming very sort of white identity politics-based, very anti-European, and quite racist, and I think in some ways also anti-Semitic. And they, the refugee crisis clearly raised questions of about government control in similar ways that to what you saw in Britain or in this election. And so the state elections, we have 16 states, and 11 have held elections since the creation of the AfD. And in, I think, 11 of the, 10 of the 11 now have the AfD in power. And they're also, of course, in the European Parliament. From what I've seen, the AfD has not made the remotest attempt at alleviating any of the grievances they rode into power criticizing. I mean, they've been pocketing state funding, and they've been using the state legislatures and the European Parliament as a place for grandstanding, but they haven't actually been trying to engage in constructive politics. And right now, now that we have seemed to have gotten a grip on the refugee situation, and now that people are frankly scared by what's been happening in America, they've been scared by Brexit, they've been scared by Brands, and by a narrow shave in the Dutch elections, which I also didn't mention, you suddenly find German polls hewing to the mean again. We're mainstreaming very clearly, and the AfD poll numbers have been going down to the single digits, and Angela Merkel, you know, has been getting increased support. I'm not particularly happy about that because she's running for the fourth time. I think she's great, but I think we should, you know, you shouldn't have leaders in power for more than two terms, and I think that that's not good for democracy. So I worry that the day she is elected, if she is elected, which seems likely now, she'll be a lame duck, of course. And that's when, you know, we'll have a conversation about what comes after her. Yeah. But is that the best possible option right now? Absolutely. Do I want to see the AfD be hammered in the elections? Of course I do. So is there a third question I could answer? Yes, it looks like it. No?
It looks like we're running out of time, but I want to give a round of applause for our speaker and thank her for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to Constance Stelzenmüller, an expert on German, European, and transatlantic foreign and security policy. This event was recorded on May 5th at an event sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.